You're listening to the Wild Tempered Wireless on 90.9 FM, and joining me now from fresh across the way there at Orchestra Hall is Maestro Murray Sidlin. Welcome, Murray, to the Wild Tempered Wireless.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here.
You are conducting the Defiant Requiem. You had a concert last night at Congregation Sherry Zedek, and two concerts coming up in Orchestra Hall. This is an amazing project, but before we get into the nuts and bolts of the Defiant Requiem versus the Verdi Requiem, there are a couple of things I wanted to mention to our listeners. First of all, you have connections with others who are have Detroit connections, like Antal Doradi, for example. Yes. You worked with him in Washington?
I did, yes. Want to see the scars?
And Peter Ungen was a protege of yours, yes?
No.
Or
no, we knew each other through Aspen.
Ah.
But he was not a protege of mine. Peter emerged as a finished, polished violinist and then conductor. I don't know that he was anybody's protege, to be honest with you.
Ah, well, there you go. Well, both Peter and Antal have many fans still in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Verdi.
But Leonard Slatkin and I have been close friends for a long time.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
And undoubtedly that may have had something to do with your presence here this weekend.
It may. And also I grew up in Baltimore, and one of the great Detroit Tigers of all time, Al Kaline. Came from Baltimore, went to high school in Baltimore.
One of the greats.
Yep.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Giuseppe Verdi had a couple of heroes. One was Rossini, and the other was an Italian poet by the name of Alessandro Manzoni. And when Manzoni passed away, he felt compelled to write this requiem. But Italy at that time was in some turmoil, wasn't it?
It was a bunch of city-states, and it was connected by language and a lot of cultural connections, but because of all kinds of political and religious interferences over a period of time, it was not a unified nation, and that was Manzoni's, I think it was his mission, his dedication. Mm-hmm. And Verdi, who was, a pretty astute politician, or let's say astute politically, he saw that and wanted that, and saw that this was a rather logical way to go. So when Manzoni died, this requiem, which had been in progress because it had been farmed out, I believe when Rossini died, I think this is the genesis of it, that there were many composers who were asked, you do the Dies Irae, you do the offertory and so forth. And nobody fulfilled, except Verdi finished the movement he was assigned, which I think was the Dies Irae. And so then when Manzoni died, he used that, and then he decided, well, I'm gonna do the whole thing, since there is no requiem that was that came out of that plan.
Probably better than what it would have been with the potpourri.
Oh, yes.
Some people refer to it as Verdi's greatest opera. It's just an incredibly dramatic piece of music, but with political overtones, yes?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's no question about it. When he writes, and nothing shall remain unavenged, it's so powerful. And the Liber Scriptus, that which is written. And it's interesting, because he chooses and edits and mentions Christ, I guess, about five or six times throughout the 90 minutes of music or 85 minutes of music. But he mentions God 16 times and mentions Abraham and Isaac and the angel Michael more times than he mentions Jesus. So there's always a question, too, about his own particular religious persuasion in the way that he selected and used the text. But it's brilliant, it's passionate, and I do believe it's very operatic, enormously dramatic.
No question. Wonderfully dramatic. And you'll be able to hear it in Orchestra Hall. You have two opportunities left. tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, and Sunday at 3 o'clock. Sunday's performance, by the way, will be webcast. And I like how the DSO is now putting times for Los Angeles, Paris, and New York on their webcasts. It's wonderful. Now, if we move forward a little bit from Verdi's, the writing of Verdi's Requiem, which would have been the late 1800s, about 60 years or so to World War II. Terezín was, before the war, a resort, is that right, in Czechoslovakia?
No, not a resort, if I may just correct a little bit. It was a town that was built in 1780 by Emperor Joseph II, and he named it after his mother, who was Terezinstadt. So, but actually, Terezín was the proper name. The Czechs don't like Terezinstadt very much, and the road signs all say Terezín. So it was a town that had a fortress adjoining it, and it was constructed during the Habsburg time, and was a defense. The town itself was developed to house 7,000 people plus the soldiers.
But once the war started, the Nazi regime turned it into a showplace concentration camp. It was like an incredibly cynical, device to show people a false picture of the way they were treating their prisoners.
That's also a very complicated statement. May I elaborate just
please.
A little bit? Okay, well, it was not designed as a showplace, but what happened is that when the arts and humanities exploded from within the prisoner population, mind you, they hadn't worked since 1939, and the camp opened late in 1941. So those who were deported or imported into Terezín, the roundup just by happenstance brought in a lot of musicians and a lot of professional people, a lot of people who were scholars in the humanities. It just happened to be that was a large percentage of the arts and humanities population in Prague and throughout the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia at the time happened to be Jewish. So they were rounded up and thrown in. And alongside of them, they imported a number of Poles, a lot of professional people there. And even 300 Danes. That's a kind of a curious question as to how that happened. But at any rate, the Danes were sent in. And the Danes were the only ones who were allowed packages, too. That was a way to placate the king of Denmark, who was very outspoken on this subject. So here they are, this very large arts and humanities population. At first, the couple of commandants didn't want them to function in any other way other than do their work, go to bed, and die. Whether they died there or died in a death camp, it was using these bodies for whatever labor they needed. And then the third commandant comes in, Commandant Rahm, and he had another objective. His objective was that he did not want to go to the Russian front. So he wanted peace and quiet in this camp. And he said, look, if having free time activity, which would result in performances or lectures, if that'll help stabilize the tone and tenor of the camp, let's do that. So that was developed, what they called the Freistellung, the free time activity. Then along came some of the arts leaders who became very significant in this. Now, you're right in that the Nazis were bragging about this place as a place that was thriving in the arts, but they weren't bringing people to see it because that would have meant remaking the place because it still was a concentration camp any way you look at it.
But did the Red Cross come by on a sort of an inspection tour, but to see how what conditions were like?
Yeah, June 23rd, 1944.
There you go.
The International Red Cross came in. That also was kind of inspired by the Danes. They wanted to know how their people were doing. So the International Red Cross comes by. Now there, for that inspection, they did gussy up the place. There were people who were actually filmed and photographed washing the streets and painting storefronts, fake storefronts. It was kind of a Potemkin village.
Mm.
And in the storefronts, let's say it says goods for sale, then the fake window had in it, on the other side, goods from the prisoners themselves. So it was not really anything for sale. There was a coffee shop, fake. There was a playground just for the visit. And
just for the visit.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, there was a whole row, to this day, if you go to Terezin, you'll see a whole row of sinks in the so-called hospital. And if you look closely, the guides will tell you, they're not connected, never were connected. Mm. It was just these sinks put up. So the whole thing was a visit to show the benevolence of the Nazis. The Jews were given a town by the Führer, and that's how they advertised it. But that was the only real visit over the period of time. So they bragged about it, but they didn't bring people to actually see, except for this Red Cross visit.
And of course, once the Red Cross left,
everything returned to the dreadful normal.
The horror. The story of the Defiant Requiem is incredible, almost literally incredible. Do I understand this correctly that when you first heard of it, you were a little skeptical and wanted to check it out?
Yes, I was. I thought it might be a good idea to prove that it didn't happen. I was very concerned about erroneous information pertaining to the Holocaust. It was just going to feed the fantasies of the deniers and the revisionists. There's a wonderful scholar at work today named Deborah Lipstadt. The movie Denial is all about the trial in England. That she was brought to trial by a denier, and she was able to prove that his material was worthless because he was actually quite vicious in his denial of the Holocaust. And so her advice is always, you know, don't talk to these people because you don't want to give them credibility. So I took from other lessons long time ago that it's when you see something that's rather incredible, check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it is not true, if it is false, you don't want to be someone who is sending this information around.
So what is the story? What was a conductor with a score?
There was a guy named one of the prisoners. His name was Raphael Schechter. He was actually Romanian, but he came to study in Brno at the Janáček Conservatory. And then after he graduated with honors, he moved to Prague. And when he was in Prague, he got a job in a opera company, a Burian opera company, a sort of like a Kurt Weill organization. And he excelled. And then the Prague Opera got interested in him. So they started offering him productions. And everybody said at the time that he was well on his way to become artistic director of the Prague Opera. Okay, war breaks out. He's interned to Terezin on a train. They don't know where. You're allowed to bring 50 kilos, about 110 pounds. And he takes with him two scores because he had no idea whether he was ever going to use these scores. He had no idea where he was going or what he was going to find. But, you know, when you bring a score or a book, that's weight. That's mm-hmm. weight that you can't use now. You're letting a sweater or a pair of shoes go by when mm-hmm. when you do that. But he did bring two scores. One was the Smetana opera, The Bartered Bride, because that's kind of like the Czech piece. Mm. I don't think we have an American opera like that. But they have this one work that's everything that you want to know about the Czech character. The humor, the mythology, the love story, love lost, and the folk elements in the music. It's a beauty. It's a great work. So he brings that score because through that work, he thought he could become more astute and attuned to Czech culture. Then he's walking back and forth with his shells and packing his 50 kilos. And for some reason, he picks out of his collection of scores, the Verdi Requiem. We think it's because it's kind of an American Express adage. Don't leave home without it. Don't go anywhere without the Verdi Requiem. My guess is that he thought at night, if he had the opportunity, he would open to any page and just relish the beauty and the extraordinary nature of. And we think because he was not much of a composer, he was more of a pianist and conductor and so forth. He probably admired the double fugues rather enormously. So he takes it with him. Okay, so he goes to Terezin. The musical environment breaks out. Suddenly there are lots of chamber music. And by the way, 20 composers at work in a new music studio.
Wow.
Composers, some of the names we know, Victor Ullmann, Hans Krause, Gideon Klein, Pavel Haas, that's the big four. But in addition to those guys, there are many others. I mean, one guy named Sigmund Schul, he studied composition with a young Paul Hindemith, and he studied conducting with a young George Zell. That's the kind of pedigree that was in this camp.
Wow.
So anyway, now almost 1,000 concerts later, we're now into 1943, Schechter decides...
1,000 concerts at Terezin?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A choral, a chamber, a new music, a cabaret, opera scenes. Every night, I mean every night, there was something going on. In addition to that, there were some 2,400 lectures given by 530 prisoners on every conceivable subject. 300 lectures on literature alone, because people read, but they couldn't bring books because of the weight. So they wanted to hear from people who wrote, or people who taught literature, and so forth. So, okay, so now Schechter decides after all these concerts, we need some sort of pinnacle. We need some sort of mountaintop. And that's when it occurred to him, let's give the Verdi a whirl. And he finds enough people to form a 150 volunteer chorus. So he's going to have to do this by rote. There's one score in the camp, and he's got it. So at night, he takes the men, the volunteer men, down into this awful, ugly, damp, dark basement that happens to have an old harmonium down there that he can bang out parts and teach them. So one night the men, the next night the women, then the men, then the women, then he puts them together for about, 25 bars, 30 bars, and he starts and keeps on going. 6 weeks, eight...
Wait, just to be clear, they're memorizing because they don't have the music.
They don't have it in front of them, no.
So he's going a few bars at a time.
Exactly.
Until they as you said, by rote.
By rote.
And the Requiem is, what, about 90 minutes?
About 90 minutes. But not all of it is choral. I mean,
right.
there's a lot of it that's solo, duet, trio, and so forth. And however, you know, he's got these young soloists from the Prague Opera, and they are glorious. I happen to have a recording of the tenor who sang all those performances. He survived, and he recorded a Verdi Requiem in Amsterdam somewhere around 1953-54. And it is extraordinary. It is a world-class voice of enormous beauty, David Gruenfeld. Mm. And he changed his name to David Garin after the war. And so I played this for a few survivors that I know who were in the chorus. And they said, oh, yes, that's David, all right. And I said, but his voice is enormously beautiful, magnificent, extraordinary, sensitive, expressive, perfect. And they said, yeah, but so were the other three.
Hmm.
That was their attitude. So the quality we know was incredible. And I asked a very well-known pianist, Edith Steiner Krauss, who just died a couple of years ago at age 100. And I said, Edith, how was the choir? Because she was at most of the performances. And her one-sentence answer was, you would be proud of this choir in any urban setting. The standard was very high.
And again, to be clear here, they would get together after a long and brutal day in the camp.
8 to 10, sometimes 12 hours.
Being
absolutely
Slave labor.
Yeah. And their reward was 2 cups of gruel a day, something that looked like liquid beets. And sometimes there was a string of something at the bottom. The elderly kept saying, please, from the bottom when you scoop it out. And so that's what they had. I happened to know someone who worked in the kitchen there. And he said, believe me, there was nothing nutritious. There was nothing nutritious at all in that collection. Well, so the big killer in camp was the lack of food, just the hunger.
And I'm sure everybody remembers photographs that we've seen of inmates. And what strikes me is it's sort of a what's the word I'm looking for here? How a human can somehow find the will, in spite of all of this horror, to rise up above it somehow.
That was one of the great functions of Raphael Schechter. He was inspirational. The people who sang in the choir, who I know or knew, some of them just passed away recently, would tell you that when he was rehearsing them, you could not whisper without bringing on the wrath of God. And it was not conductorial ego. It was that he would not permit them to think about the hunger, the illness, the terror, the degradation, the fear. Where's my husband? Where's my child? Where all of those? He would not permit it. That this requiem was going to be something inside them. In fact, one of the singers told me, this is a quote, "We were so far inside the music, we had returned to Verdi's desk." I mean, what a statement. Wow. What a statement.
My guest is Murray Sidlin. He'll be conducting the Defiant Requiem, music of Verdi, with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, full chorus and soloists in Orchestra Hall, Saturday night at 8, Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. You have to be there. I'm telling you, you have to be there. The Verdi Requiem alone would be an attraction. But let's get into, I mean, you're going to have all the forces there for a full-blown Verdi Requiem, but there's more to what we will see tomorrow night and Sunday afternoon than I don't want to say just the Verdi Requiem, but there's even more.
Yes. First of all, there'll be two actors, one representing what we know was the perspective of Raphael Schechter, why he did what he did, and how he handled the critique from the Council of Jewish Elders, who were accusing him by saying, what you're doing is giving a Catholic service, but you're calling it a concert. So he had to fight that, the issue of a Catholic work in a place where everybody was Jewish. The other actor we call the lecturer, and she is a composite of 5 different people and different perspectives. I'm one of the narrators, and I sort of operate like the stage manager in our town. I kind of bring us here and bring us there, and then I conduct it. Yeah, so there's that narrative between movements. In addition to that, there are videos of people who sang in the choir and their perspective of what it was like. These are actual members of the Terezin Choir.
Again, you can get more information at dso.org. That's dso.org. You've got a wonderful cast that supports the performance here. Jennifer Czech, soprano, and McMahon Quintero, mezzo. Izaka, is that right?
Izakaya.
Mm-hmm. Forgive me. Tenor. Nathan Stark, bass. The Community Chorus of Detroit, prepared by Ed Mackey Schramm. And, of course, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Marie Sidlin conducting.
The beautiful Detroit Symphony Orchestra. My God, what an orchestra. Lovely.
Had you worked with them before?
No, I haven't. But Leonard's been telling me for years, you ought to hear them. And I kept saying, yeah, I'm sure they're good. Well, no, they're more than good. They're really superb. Superb.
We kind of like them.
Yep. You ought to be very proud of them. I'm sure you are.
Indeed.
Very proud of them.
Kind of like the hall, too.
The hall is magnificent.
Yeah.
Magnificent, really.
The Verdi Requiem. I can't imagine where else I'd rather be this weekend. than seeing this. Murray Sidlin, I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Chris. I just want to say one more thing about the objective, and that is I started this after I learned about Schechter to try to put him in the position of one of the great heroes of the Holocaust.
He saved lives,
he
didn't he?
Certainly
with
saved
this.
Lives. Yeah. Not only the singers, but the listeners. He yeah. inspired them,
yeah.
harmoniously inspired them. And then in addition to that, the Verdi Requiem may be the second most performed oratorio next to the Messiah around the world. And I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if every time someone heard the Verdi Requiem or sang the Verdi Requiem, they thought about the prisoners of Terezin.
Yeah.
So those are the two objectives.
Indeed. Murray Sidlin, again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chris.
And your artistry.
Thank you. You're very kind to have me on this morning.
It's we had to. It's the Verdi Requiem after all.